Hello, everybody, and welcome to the 14th episode of the Fan to Fan podcast, brought to you both by Pro Wrestling Ponderings and the WrestleFolks Podcast Network. Be sure to follow both on Twitter at PW Ponderings and at WrestleFolks, respectively. Subscribe to both on either iTunes or Stitcher Radio. Leave a kind review. Let's get the rankings to climb for both of these wrestling podcast networks. Let everybody hear what great podcasts we got going on. And if you are so inclined, please visit ProWrestlingPonderings.com for all the great content we have there, reviews, analysis, results, other podcasts. It's all up there for you. And while you're there, it is the time of year, folks. We're approaching Black Friday, Cyber Monday, Christmas, all the other holidays. While you're on ProWrestlingPonderings.com or PWPonderings.com, if you're going to be buying stuff through Amazon.com or maybe even through HighSpots.com for yourself or for the wrestling fan of your life, please use the banners on PWPonderings.com. All the prices are the same. You get the same great deals from both websites. The only difference is we get a small kickback of whatever you pay. And for all the free content and stuff we're giving you, it'd really mean a lot to us if you would do that for us. So in advance, I want to say thank you to everybody. Also, pass the word along to your friends and family. If they're going to be buying through Amazon, why not have them go through PWPonderings.com and use our link? We'd be very much appreciated. The guest this week is Tom Richards of the Uncle Mike and Tom Show. We talk a lot about Tom growing up as a fan during the territory periods in the early 80s, the switch over from that, talking about his days as a fan of ECW. You get to hear his side of the story of the fire chair Mick Foley story that Leonard F. Shikarsen talked about in his episode, and then becoming a fan of the indies in the early 2000s when the indies were sort of revolutionizing what they became today. Before we get to that conversation, I want to talk about Tom Green, who was last week's guest. And thank you, first off, to everybody who listened to that episode. I got a lot of great feedback from people about it. People seem to enjoy it. I know it was on the longer side, but I appreciate everybody sticking with it. So that's all that. This week, though, Tom put out an episode of Wrestle Folks that was only about 20 minutes. It wasn't him talking about wrestling in any way. It wasn't him with a guest. It was him just sort of venting and getting some feelings and frustrations out there. And I don't really want to go into the content of it because that's Tom's story to share. And if you want to listen to it, it's up for you. Go to, again, WrestleFolks on Twitter or WrestleFolks.wordpress.com. Find it through there if you feel so inclined to listen to it. I know when you're in the state of mind of somebody like Tom that there's really nothing that people can say to change your mind or make you feel at ease. It's just kind of something that you ride out and kind of deal with. But I figured after hearing that, I'd want to come on here and share a story about Tom Green to sort of give you an idea of the kind of person I think he is. In 2005, I was diagnosed with Crohn's disease, which if you don't know what that is, it's an intestinal disease. Food gets hard to process. Blood cells fight the disease pretty hard, so they die out. It was something that I had to, it was an awful struggle at the time. But I'm glad to say that I got diagnosed. Everything's great now. Pretty much just with medication, I can live my life as a normal person. But there are certain things that people with this disease or similar diseases have to do in sort of watching what they eat and what they drink and whatever else. And everybody's different, so some things affect you, some things don't. You just kind of have to have a try-and-see approach. And earlier this year, I had an episode with that in about late April, and it kind of hurt. And it was something I had to deal with for a good couple of months. And eventually I went to the doctors and figured out what the problem was. And I got put on a new medication to sort of regulate things. And I started feeling pretty crummy mentally. Like physically I was getting better and I could understand the disease was getting better. But there were certain mornings where it was harder to get out of the bed in the morning. I became more apathetic, lethargic. Little things started to piss me off. My relationship at the time with my then girlfriend was really consuming me in a really awful way. And I didn't really know how to deal with it. And I was just researching this new medication I was on. It turns out, guess what? Side effect is depression. So I had to deal with depression for about a good month as I was getting better. And I would talk to some friends and parents about it because I'm certainly not the type of person to bottle up emotions or try to deal with issues on my own. I'm a fan of the talking cure. I feel talking to people helps out a lot. I guess you can say that's why a part of this podcast exists. But I talked to Tom because I know he had similar issues, and I figured since he's a married man, maybe he could relate to some of my relationship woes I was going through. And to say he was helpful was really an understatement. He understood exactly what I was going through. He had some great advice for me. He had some really relatable tales, and it was just nice to have someone in my corner who could understand what I was going through because, you know, I don't think unless you've had a bout of depression, you really understand what it's all about. And to have Tom there for me when this was all completely brand new to me and I really had no idea what to do or I could fix it. Just talking to him was super helpful, and I really appreciated him being there for me. And this was also around the time when I was thinking about starting the Fan to Fan podcast, and I was talking about it. Tom invited me onto his podcasting network, and I can tell you, as someone who owns a wrestling website, you don't just want anybody to come on and write for you or do a podcast for you or that. It's kind of your reputation on the line. So the fact that he would take a chance with me coming on his network and hosting my show meant a lot, because he knew I was hosting it on Pro Wrestling Ponderings, and he knew that this would kind of be my priority. But the fact that he was more than willing to syndicate it means the world to me, and it still does. And it's been a few months now, and I'm doing great. And I'm happy to see this show is going strong, and I'm glad to see it have a presence on Tom's website, because I really love all the other shows in his network. I listen to them every week. I'm a fan of the shows, as in addition to being a show on the network. So for Tom to do that to me means a great deal. So, Tom, I know you're listening. I just want to say thanks, man. Thanks for everything you've done for me. I really, really appreciate it. But now that's out of the way, let's get into some wrestling talk with Tom Richards. All right, Tom Richards, how's it going, man?
What's going on, Kevin, man?
I'm actually, in your honor, drinking a Yingling as we record this.
Miller Lite, so that's good.
From your home state of Pennsylvania. Swig one for the working man.
Exactly. In my experience of over the years of podcasting, podcasts always seem to come off better when you're drinking a couple of cold ones.
Yeah, as Conan likes to say, he likes to go to Iran. Either way, whatever you'd like to imbibe in.
I'm very much down with that, too. So let's say I'm drinking a Miller Lite and am in Iran right now, too. Boom.
There you go. All right, well.
What a good way to start.
I know, right? This is, oh my gosh. I can't imagine what some people have to say about it. But that's neither here nor there. We're here to talk about pro wrestling. And Tom, you've been a fan for a really long time. Take me back.
Man, 1980. I was a six-year-old kid. And I remember this. My mom comes in the living room and goes, "Ooh, my girlfriend Gloria told me to put this show on." And she put on wrestling. It was WWF. And there I was, a six-year-old kid, and now, 34 years later, I'm still watching without missing a beat.
Do you remember what the show was, like what the matches were? Or?
I remember when she turned on, it was Don Morocco against somebody in a squash match. That's all I remember about that first time, you know, that very first time. But I was hooked immediately, and like within months, we started going, like, they would come here locally to Scranton, Pennsylvania, like, every month to the Catholic Youth Center, to CYC. And we started going every month. My mom would take me and her girlfriend's kids, and we would go sit in the same seats every month and watch, you know. And I remember my very first card there, Bob Backlund defended the world title against Greg Valentine in the main event. I remember that because I ran to the ring to the guardrail and touched Greg Valentine's robe. And at 6 years old, I thought it was the greatest thing ever.
Oh, yeah. Any interaction at that age really is the best thing ever.
And the one thing I remember, we were second row, and the only other thing I remember on that show is Tiger Mask was on that show, and he did a dive over the top rope right in front of us to the floor when we were second row. And that, like, in 1980, people didn't do dives over the top rope to the outside, you know?
No.
Jimmy Snuka is the only one that really climbed the ropes at all back then.
Yeah, you became a fan like at a really unique time when like Tiger Mask was around, like it was still territorial, so they would be running a state in an area like Pennsylvania every month because they weren't doing the national thing yet. So,
well, exactly, it was all regionalized. So WWF was Capital Sports, and they would run like New York, Pennsylvania, Maryland, and the whole New England area, and that was their territory, and they really didn't run outside of that area at all.
No, wow, that's bizarre to think about, even just like the regional time. Did you just get WWF television?
Actually, like in 1980, yeah, that's all we got. That was the I'm not sure if there was other stuff on. I don't think there was, because like in that time, 80, 81, 82, cable was still in its beginnings, you know?
Right.
Spit that word on out there.
Infancy.
Yeah, like, because, gee, I remember we got 12 channels. You'd have to go up to the TV and change the knob on the TV and go from 1 to 12, and that's all you got, you know?
Right, so you got the one wrestling you were lucky to get in your area.
But what I do remember is 1982, I remember flipping through on a Sunday morning, and wrestling was on USA Network. And I was like, ooh, wow, what is this? I remember Bob Sweetin was on and Tully Blanchard, and it was Southwest Wrestling. And boom, I immediately loved that. And I started watching that every Sunday morning. You know, I go looking for cartoons and I found more wrestling. Awesome, you know? But one day, suddenly that disappeared and became WWF at the time. And that went on to be All American Wrestling.
Mm. That happened to me too, I think, when I first discovered WCW, when you're just going through channels, flipping through them with really no agenda, and you pop on this new wrestling you've never seen before, and you're like, this is a whole new world. Like, this is amazing.
But this is how weird and different it was back then. Like, so WWF would run, like, their big shows every month at Madison Square Garden. The Boston Gardens and the Philly Spectrum were, like, their big three, and the Maple Leaf Gardens in Toronto. And so every month when they ran at the Spectrum in Philly, it was on a channel called Prism, which was an old pay channel like HBO, but it was more like a Philadelphia base where that's where they had the Sixers games and the Flyers games, and the Phillies would be on there. And then they'd have movies when they're like a regular HBO would when there wasn't no games on.
Mm-hmm.
So what we would do is we would actually – me and my mom would go down to my grandparents and my uncle, and we would sit in the living room, and this was a paid channel, and actually watch the scrambled feed of the Spectrum show and just listen to it. A whole living room watching a scrambled feed. How crazy is that?
That is definitely just a product of its time. Like, start telling a kid that in, like, 20 years. They'll just think you're right? Bizarre, like you're making it up.
And then I think the best – one of my favorite childhood memories is the day my grandfather came home and he had an illegal box that got HBO in prison for free. So we were able to watch Spectrum Wrestling unscrambled.
I take it that your mom was a wrestling fan and she's the one who got you into it, really.
Yeah, but it's weird. Like, she stopped watching like around 1985 when it started getting all Hulk Hogan and cartoony, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, like both my grandparents were hardcore. They would always watch it. Actually, it was my grandfather. Like, anytime I'd be over there, he'd have wrestling on. And that's how I actually found out about primetime wrestling, because he'd be turning it on when it first started, like 85, 86, somewhere in there. I was like, wow, what is this? You know, Monday night, you know?
Were you part of the time where you would also, when you were getting more into wrestling, go out and buy the magazines or buy the videos or anything like that?
Absolutely, because I have an uncle that's like 4 years older than me, so it's almost like a bigger brother, and like me and him would always go to newsstands and buy the magazines, and like you'd see all the pictures of Ric Flair and Dusty Rhodes, but like you would never see them on TV, but I just read about these guys in the magazines, you know?
Yeah, because even when I was a kid and I'd be buying like wrestling books or magazines or something, like even if it was accessible, even things like when I was really young, seeing pictures from like ECW, I'd be like, I have no idea who any of these wrestlers are. Like, what is this? And I wanted to know. I wanted to seek it out and see how I could see all this stuff. And it always seemed to be like more big and grandiose seeing in pictures than when you actually see it, you're just like, oh, okay. That's
right.
What that is.
And with the magazines, as it got in the later 80s and I got to like junior high and high school, a lot of my circle of friends always seem to have wrestling in common. That's always been the thing I had in common with most of my friends. And like the magazines became the way to continue following the territories and what was going on. Like we would know the dates exactly, like Pro Wrestling Illustrated, Inside Wrestling, The Wrestler, and Sports Review were all done by the same – the aftermags, you know? And they would come out, two of them, every other Tuesday. And I remember after school riding to the corner store to pick up the two magazines because they'd be like $1.75 each, you know? And like reading them cover to cover to see what was going on in all the different territories because you couldn't get to see them on TV.
See, you're lucky because when I was a kid, I had like no friends who liked wrestling. So I kind of just had to watch it and explore all that kind of on my own. We're now like, you know, we're in the age where I could just go on Twitter and there's like 100 people I could talk to about wrestling.
Exactly. Like, and it wasn't like growing up, especially like in the late 80s, man, and early 90s, it was like it wasn't cool to be a wrestling fan, at least up here in the Northeast, you know? And so that was like a secret. Like you didn't wear wrestling shirts to school or nothing. That was like, you just didn't happen, you know? And so when you met someone else that a wrestling fan, I was like, ooh, we're like in a secret club, you know?
And even like looking at the magazines and the merchandise they had back then, like who would be caught dead wearing any of that stuff anyways? I feel like I could wear like a rocker shirt that they had and be like funny and retro. But like if I'm a kid wearing that shirt like back then, I'm getting my ass kicked the minute I walk in the door.
Exactly. Like I remember my buddy was, his family was real rich. So he'd always be buying like all the merchandise and stuff. He'd have all the t-shirts, but he would never wear them out anywhere. It'd only be when he's, you know, messing around the house, playing out in the yard, but he would never wear them out in public.
Totally. Like I know I still have people who wear like their wrestling shirts only to the gym or like to do yard work or things like that.
Exactly.
But I feel like even like, you know, part of the wrestling boom where it became more popular and more accessible was like, you know, people didn't have problems wearing like a DX or an NWO or Austin 316 shirt. Like those look cool. They were just
t-shirts
you think like a metal band or something would have put out, but you're not going to wear some bright yellow and pink and purple shirt to school for anything really. Like, especially by the 90s with wrestling being kind of behind the trends, like all that stuff was over by the time, like, you know, that merchandise was relevant in the WWF and WCW.
Exactly. But man, when that Austin hit, that was like so crazy. Like you could get an Austin t-shirt in like any store in the mall and stuff. It was like its own brand, you know?
Yeah. It was one of those things where wrestling was like kind of difficult to find. Tours everywhere. Like, you couldn't walk around a corner without, or like you said, going to a shopping mall and, like, every place had them. It's nuts. I still remember, like, seeing, like, Austin 316 Beanie Baby knockoffs and being like, this is the epitome of the late 90s right here in my hand. Both of those things. But you were also, so you were a teenager by the time the 90s happened. And obviously, you know, the 90s.
Like, by time, I graduated in 93, so, like, at that point, wrestling was really going in the dumps. Like, 93 to 95, it was, like, a really bad period because all the territories were dying, and WWE was at its absolute worst, you know? Like, Vince was going through a steroid trial. Like, the creative was terrible. So it was, like, wrestling, it was, like, going – I remember they were taping Monday Night Raw at a high school, a Danville High School, like, 30 minutes from here. And it's like in a high school gym, they were taping Monday Night Raw. That's how down the wrestling business was in the mid-90s.
Yeah, even like watching back, like, you know, the Manhattan Center is not a big place at all, but at least it kind of had that feel of being something cool. And then like you go to like 94, 95, even a little bit in 96, and they're just in these tiny places. And you're just like, why is a wrestling show happening here? It's so bizarre.
It's like, so I was going, like I said, to the Scranton CYC since 1980, and I specifically remember it was like the spring of 97 area, and we were sitting, like we'd always go up to CYC early, hang out in back when the wrestlers show up and hang out afterwards, and I remember we were just sitting there hanging out, and like there was people walking around with signs looking for tickets, and I'm like, looking for tickets? This place never sells out. What the hell's going on? And that's like the first time it hit me that something, like, we're getting a big explosion, and all of a sudden the shirts are showing up in the shopping malls. It's like something big's going on here, you know? And like I was already like 17, 18, 19, you know, at this point. It was like something crazy's going on. It's never been like this.
Mm-hmm. Now you mentioned the Vince McMahon steroid trial. Did you see there was this article posted recently about like the history of steroid stuff in WWF?
No, I didn't.
Yeah, it's really fascinating because it goes about like it's talking about how, you know, does the wellness testing have in place? Does it really work? And it talks about, you know, the differences in steroids and how, you know, HGH like can't be detected in certain ways, or like the level for testosterone in a male is higher than it is for the NFL. And it talked about that time with the steroid trial in 94 and how so many guys were getting cycled out or fired, and, you know, bodies started to change with a lot of these people.
Yeah.
And I'd heard about this a little bit, but I didn't really realize that it was Nails of all people who had this testimony that they pointed to and said, you know, this guy has a legitimate gripe with Vince McMahon, so he has reason to come up here and lie. And they kind of threw up the case because they just said all the witnesses were untrustful. And I'm wondering, like, man, if they really had nailed McMahon back then, like, how different would have things been?
It would have just changed the way history, you know, was written, like without Vince, I don't know what would, I mean, he had Jerry Jarrett in place to run it while he was gone, but you really don't know how things would have worked out. And it being such a down period, it would have been definitely different if Vince went to jail. And I tell you, at the time, like, cause I started getting the Pro Wrestling Torch in 1991. And then I started getting Wrestling Observer in 93. And like, so I was reading them like during the steroid trial. And it was like, man, I thought for sure he was going to jail, man. I thought he was dead to rights. There's no way he's getting out of this, you know? But yeah, the whole Nails thing, it's like he said, oh, he made me take steroids. And it's like Nails' whole body is covered up with a jail, with a prison jumpsuit, you know?
Yeah.
And that was.
And not to mention, like, you know, the whole thing about him attacking Vince McMahon for his SummerSlam 92 payoff being too low. Like, you could point to all those things and kind of just throw it out. But you know, reading about all that stuff and just seeing how poor the business was back in 94 and 95 for WWF, and, you know, people talk about there was real danger of that company closing. You got to wonder, like, what would have happened if the trial had went down differently, if the Attitude Era boom had never happened. Like, would WWF even still be around today?
Exactly, because there was like even a period like maybe 95, 96, somewhere there, where they were losing money. And if you recall, the whole Montreal screw job started and actually happened because they couldn't afford Bret Hart's contract anymore.
Right. And funny and enough, that's the thing that turned business around.
Yeah. And it's never looked back since. And now they got everything set up so good. They have like nothing to worry about forever and a day.
No, yeah, everything's going to be fine. If nothing else, like I always say this, but their tape library is the best asset they have. And they're going to make money off that thing forever. If their product could suck forever. And they could still make money off the network, off DVDs, everything else, because people long for that stuff. Like one of my friend's roommates, he keeps up sort of with the current product, but what he's most interested in is just going on YouTube or buying DVDs of stuff he watched as a kid.
Oh, exactly. So I have the biggest VHS collection of wrestling tapes you've ever seen, man. I have a goddamn storage that with just VHS wrestling tapes in it, man.
Is this stuff you recorded yourself? Were you a tape trader? What's the deal there?
I started out, for whatever reason, as young as I can remember, like I would record like any big show like that was on TV, whether it was like a Clash of Champions or Saturday Night's Main Event, or my buddy, like we didn't, my local cable company actually didn't even have pay-per-view available until Tuesday in Texas in late 91. So my buddy would go to his aunt's house where they had pay-per-view, and he would order the pay-per-views there and tape and then give me a copy to watch. So I just started out getting all the copies of the WWF pay-per-views like in the late 80s, you know? Mm-hmm. And then I'd always tape the Clash of Champions and the Saturday Night's Main Event. And it just started building. And then like the WCW, once 91 came, I started ordering all the WCWs, and my buddy up the street would order WWF. So we got every single pay-per-view all year. And I was one of them guys, anytime I went into a new town and seen a videotape store, I'd pull over and park and go see what wrestling tapes they had there, you know. If there was anything good, I wanted to rent it out and go make a copy and bring it back.
Ah, see, my friend did that too. Not with wrestling, but I'd always go to his house and he had like stacks of like 70, 80, 100 plus blank tapes, because he'd go to Blockbuster, stick it in his dual VCR deal, just tape the whole thing and then return it, and he has that movie forever. So, and I feel exactly. Like there's a weird thing with wrestling fans, or at least certain wrestling fans, where there's this necessity to acquire as much footage as humanly possible. So it's like, man, any tape you can get your hands on, any pay-per-view, any season of Raw or Superstars or whatever else, there's just a need to have it. Never mind the fact that there's no way we're ever going to go back and watch all of it. There's just some compulsion to it. And I have it too. I have definitely a DVD collection habit when it comes to wrestling, but it's just the nature of it, I guess.
And then my podcast co-host, Uncle Mike, he's been taping all wrestling TV for decades. So he's got like the entire Monday Night War from both sides. And to this day, he tapes all the TV. I don't even know why, man. You know, and he's just got stacks and stacks of DVDs and VHS tapes of TV wrestling over the years.
Yeah, especially now there's just too much of it. And a lot of it you can just find on, like, you know, you can find tons of Raws and SmackDowns and all that on Hulu Plus and everything else. And WWE puts up tons of classic matches on their YouTube channel. Like, if people aren't looking at their YouTube, there's lots of great stuff on there.
Yeah.
So I don't know. Like, and I just feel like that's so much. So does he really record like every like Raw, SmackDown, Superstars
Yeah, he has
main
them
event?
all. It's, I don't, I stopped recording. I didn't even keep the pay-per-views anymore or nothing. You know, the only thing I keep is all the indie shows now, but like the major league stuff, like TNA, we ordered every single Wednesday night TNA pay-per-view. Me, Uncle Mike, and everybody went three ways in it, so it'll be like $3 each every Wednesday night. We recorded every single one on SP speed on VHS, and they're, to this day, their quality's awesome.
I feel like, and I guess it's a little different with TNA because their DVDs just, I mean, they pretty much only do pay-per-views now. They used to do compilations, but don't. But I feel like especially with WWE, there's really not a lot of value to taping their TV because all the best stuff's going to come out on official DVDs anyway.
Exactly, exactly. And it's like, really, how many times in your life are you going to go back and watch a particular episode of Raw or SmackDown? It's just not going to happen. There's not enough hours in the day, you know?
Mm-hmm. It was the last taping WWE did of the year. It was on a Monday. It was like right before New Year's. So they taped every show that night. And, oh no, you know, it was right before WrestleMania. But so they taped every show and then they were all going to go down to New York. And they taped one Superstars match because I'm sure the rest of the show was all video packages. I don't watch Superstars. But it was the Great Khali versus JTG. And I just like, I would never watch this match in a million years if I was not sitting in this chair right now. So the idea of someone recording it for posterity is just mind-boggling.
I hear you, but he's still doing it. But hell, that's good for me. If I ever miss a show, I can just get the disc off of him, man.
Hey, do you happen to have that Fandango Biggie Langston tag match? I need to see that. Well, the thing I think, you know, talking on listening to your show and just talking to you, I think what most people know you for is being a big ECW fan back in the 90s.
Yeah, and like so that's the thing. So like I have my high school friends that were wrestling fans, and my one friend John in particular was this huge fan. And like what he would do is right behind our high school was like the middle of downtown Wilkes-Barre, and they had two newsstands there. He figured out a way that he can go in there every day and stuff a wrestling magazine in his book bag and snake out and steal it without getting caught. So he would walk around school with a book bag full of wrestling magazines. So I would just borrow a magazine off of him every day to look at. He had them all, you know, because he'd steal them all. It was crazy how they would never notice wrestling magazines stolen like every day, you know?
Right.
But anyway, the reason I mentioned him is he calls me to one day. He's like, hey, I'm down my grandparents, and there's this wrestling on Sports Channel called ECW. He's like, you want me to tape it so he could check it out? I'm like, yeah, why not? Because in 1993, there was really just WWF and WCW and nothing else really around the city, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So I was like, yeah, record it. We'll check it out. So he would go up every Tuesday, record at his grandparents, and I'd go pick him up and we'd take it back to my place and watch it, you know? And like 93 ECW was pretty goddamn bad. But I thought it was awesome because Paul Heyman was there, and I've always been a Paul Dangerously Mark, you know, a Paul Heyman guy through and through. And it was cool seeing like Don Morocco and Jimmy Snuka and some of the old time guys that were winding out their career, and they had like most of the local Philly indie guys who weren't very good. But so we would watch it every week, and it'd be like more times than not we'd joke about how terrible it actually is and how sad it is to see some of the guys. But somewhere along the way, it started getting like good, you know? And I remember somewhere like in the middle of like 94, suddenly like other friends were like, yo, man, you got any of them ECW tapes? You want to check them out? It became like this hot thing, you know? Where it was like, wow, man, this promotion's become really goddamn good. To where it was like, man, we got to see this every Tuesday. You know, it was on 6 to 7. 7 o'clock would come. I'd be calling on the phone. Let's go get that tape, you know? And we're like, man, Philly's like 2 hours away. We got to take a ride down there and check one of these out live, you know?
Yeah, that's kind of the great thing about being in the area you are, is especially now, there's just so much wrestling that you can completely take it for granted.
Exactly.
So it's funny you mentioned like the ECW early day stuff, because when I was getting into ECW a little bit, like watching it on TNN and getting some of like the Pioneer videos, I'd go online and check out some of the past results. Like looking at the early days and seeing that like Jimmy Snuka and Don Morocco and all these other guys were in it, I'm like, this isn't even the same company on paper.
No.
Like a couple of the names are kind of the same, but really you know, that you after know, the Shane Douglas NWA yeah. title thing, like it sort of just changed the whole company. And then that was kind of like the beginning of the rise for it. And now it's the ECW that we all know and love.
Oh, it happens. Ty Gordon was part of Tri-State Wrestling that was in the area before ECW. And Joe Goodhart closed up shop and took off. And Todd still wanted to invest in something. So he like had a connection to Terry Funk through ECW.
Right.
And he started it up. And he brought in Terry Funk. And they ended up bringing Eddie Gilbert in the book. And
Funk was – I hate to interrupt, but wasn't Funk on the first show and he did like a promo at the end, like apologizing for how terrible it was?
Yeah, they taped some TV. Well, they were taping – they were doing some bar shows, and they were taping TV at a college campus. I forget the name of the college off the top of my head. And it was like a small school in Philly, you know? And the sure. first shows were terrible, man. Like, you can go back and watch the first TV tapings, and it's really bad, you know? It's just not good at all. But they brought in Eddie Gilbert to book, and Eddie Gilbert was a tremendous booker and an awesome character. But by the time he came to ECW, his drug habit had really gotten out of control. And basically, Eddie Gilbert was just booking it like the company around himself, like he was Jerry Lawler, because Lawler was his idol. He made himself the king of Philadelphia, and he was just doing all kinds of stuff that Lawler did in Memphis, you know? And he had some kind of falling out with Ty Gordon, and Ty ended up giving the book to Paul Lee, and that's when things just started taking off. Everything just started coming together, you know?
Yeah, I remember hearing about all that. And, yeah, again, it's just a completely different company, and it's one of those things you just wonder, like, what if this, what if that? But yeah, ECW really was just kind of this juggernaut that you just kind of heard about a little bit out of the corner, and then, poof, it was gone.
I know. It's like I'm so happy I lived through it, because it's like the 95 and 96 are like two of the – best years of my life, just being like 20 and 21 and the whole ECW experience. It was like so awesome to live through, and it's something I'll never forget, you know?
How many shows did you go to?
My story is very similar to Leonard Chikarison's when he was on. We started going in early 80 or 85, early 95, and stopped going like early 97 to the arena. But what happened was they finally got on TV in New York on MSG Network. And so my buddy up the street seen it. And it was the night that Raven debuted. And he called me up the next day. He's like, I finally seen this ECW you were talking about. We got to go to one of these shows. And like once he was on board, because he had the car, you know, I was like, we're going to go. You know, he's the one that's got the car that can drive 2 hours away, you know. And I'll never forget, we were sitting there on a Friday night. It was in March, and it was college basketball tournament time. And the games just went off. It was like 5 o'clock, and we're bored. And he's like, oh, I was watching that ECW. I think they're in Jim Thorpe tonight. Isn't that close to here? And I'm like, oh, I have no idea. And so I looked it up on a map, and I'm like, yeah, it doesn't seem that far from here, you know? So we got directions, and just on the spur of the moment, we went to ECW show in Jim Thorpe, Pennsylvania at the Flagstaff. And this place, man, the Flagstaff is a bar that's on a cliff up in the middle of nowhere, you know?
Right.
So typical wrestling little town. Like, I don't even remember where I got directions from to get to this place. So we're following, we take this right turn, and it's like road, it's like a, literally like, barely more than enough size for one car to go up and down this road. And it's just like going in circles up this hill in the woods. And my buddy's like, there's no way there's a wrestling show up here. And sure enough, we get to the top, and there's this bar with a big front window, and all I see is a wrestling ring, and I see women standing and taking Polaroids before the show. I'm like, holy shit, there is a show up here. Like, they had like a back part of it where like you go outside on a deck and it's just literally a cliff dropping hundreds of feet down into the woods.
Why there of all places? Must have been cheap, I guess.
I don't know who got them the building or what. I know Ed Zahn, who had a promoter's license at the time, ran other shows after ECW started or stopped running there. So I don't know if he's the one that got them the building or what, but I thought it was like for just something different. It was such a fun place. Just being in a bar at ECW was perfect.
Oh, sure. That's the right atmosphere.
It was jam-packed with drunks. It was different. That's for sure.
Were these drunks who were ECW fans or just people who went to the bar that day having no idea there was a wrestling show?
I think a combination of both. There's definitely a bunch of wrestling fans, and there's definitely a bunch of people that came to drink, and there's wrestling at the bar this night, so yeah, we're going to watch some wrestling. And it made for an awesome atmosphere, that's for sure.
I always wonder, because some wrestling shows still do those bar shows sometimes, and watching them, the atmosphere is really cool just because it's so different. But you always see, like, that family who's off in the distance, like, eating dinner, who had no idea, like, what in God's name is going on? Like, why did we decide to eat here? Why not anywhere else on the planet Earth? And it's always so amazing. Right? I want to, like, hear from those people what they think of all the madness. That's really what I care about most is like, when non-wrestling fans happen to see wrestling, what they happen to think of it. Like what's going on? Especially in those kind of atmospheres.
So after we went to that show, we were like, fuck, man, this is awesome. We got to go to Philly for an actual arena show. Because, like, they would usually actually do the Flagstaff shows the night before Philly. So they'd use a lot of the locals and a few of the fly-ins, you know. So it wasn't always like the loaded shows you'd see at the arena. But they were just fun for the atmosphere. And just because, you know, live wrestling's live wrestling in 1995.
So the Flagstaff show you went to was in 1995?
Yeah.
Okay.
That was like March.
Yeah, I just wanted a frame of reference for when that time was.
Yeah, it was March 95. So then we went to the next arena show, which was Three Way Dance in April of 95. And that was an experience going down to Philly for the first time, man. It was pretty awesome just to be down there in that city and going to ECW. Like, I remember, like, we got there, like, 3 p.m. and like the line was already started, and it was cool because like you would sit in that line and people would be barbecuing and drinking, and people would be sitting there with the torch and the observer and passing pages around to each other, because like in 1995 there was an internet, but like the majority of people didn't have it, you know.
Right.
So this was like how everyone was finding out what was going on. They're passing around pages of the Observer and a torch up and down the line of people sitting outside in front of the building at 3 p.m, you know?
Yeah, because those seem like those would be the type of fans to go to ECW shows.
Oh, it was. Like, they were really, really smart. Like I said, they'd sit there reading the Observer and Torch. And back in them days, you know, except for the people that read that stuff, nobody really knew what was going on. Because even, like, on the internet, like, there wasn't that much wrestling in 1995, you know?
And even in the Observer in that time, like, an Observer from 95, like, compared to now, there's just such scant information in there.
Oh, exactly, man. That's the one thing I'll give Meltzer, man. Like, when the internet got big, that's kind of like, I thought, oh, this is it for like the Torch and the Observer, and there was the Wrestling Lariat. And Meltzer, I thought, has done the best job in continuing to put out a product that you want to read, and just because you have the internet, it doesn't really kill it. He goes so in-depth on stories and stuff now that it's, if you really want information, it's the best place to go. Like, I don't understand people that still order the Torch, man. I don't get it, you know?
I don't know. I never was a Torch reader. I listened to a couple of, like, when I was first getting into podcasts back in, I think it was, like, 05, and I was just searching iTunes for, obviously, first thing I searched for, wrestling podcasts. And I listened to a few, like, the few ones that Wade Keller put up and a few that that Alvarez had put up at the time. That's the only really bit of Torch stuff I've seen aside from, like, I think Wade might have been in Barbed Wire City a little bit and just a couple other documentaries and shoots here and there. But I've never actually read a Torch.
I remember in 91, Mike Tenay was doing this radio show, and it would come on like 10, 11 o'clock on a Saturday night and be on to like midnight or 1. And I like accidentally found it on the AM dial one night, you know, and this was great because it was all insider talk. And they'd have, you know, wrestlers on as guests and whatnot. And then every week they'd have either Meltzer or Wade Keller on to answer questions. And, like, to me back then when they would each come on, I thought Wade Keller was so much better with answering the questions and giving you straight answers than Meltzer was, you know? And, like, the Torch, The Torch was a very easy thing to read from cover to cover. Like, they had the headline story in the front page. You'd open it up. They had WWF news. Page three was WCW news. Page four was miscellaneous news, you know? And then they had the Torch talk, and it was like that every single week, you know? It was very easy to read. You knew where everything was at. Where the Observer is kind of still like Dave does it. Like, stuff's all over the place, you know? This news story after news story, there's, like, no rhyme or reason. And, so, like, I guess as being younger, like, I thought the Torch was easier to read on an every week basis.
Were you getting, but like, now, all were you getting all the different newsletters when you were younger, or just reading them through friends?
Well, what would happen is my one buddy that I mentioned had a lot of money. For Christmas every year, his parents would get him a year's subscription to the Torch. So I would just read his Torch every week for free, and I would order the Observer, and sometimes I started ordering the Wrestling Lariat. I even have some of the very early issues of the Figure Four Weekly, and it was only four pages long, you know?
Mm-hmm. And it's funny looking now, like, how, like, if you read the, since they're both on the same site, like, you read the Figure Four and you read the Wrestling Observer, like, how they're both structured. They're both structured pretty identically at this point. So you can see Alvarez getting a lot of influence from Meltzer.
Oh, definitely. Yeah, because when Alvarez first started, a lot of Figure Four Weekly, it was a lot of comedy written type, and it was really driven by its comedy. And it was just, like, four pages. There wasn't much to it. And I always used to laugh and think, man, I wonder who's actually getting this instead of the Torch or the Observer, you know, or the Lariat at the time. It was like, man, good for him that he can make it. And he's still here. It blows my mind that he's still here after all these years. I give him credit for finding a way to make it.
Well, and, you know, partnering up with Meltzer and getting him to do all, you know, like the four or so Wrestling Observer radios each week is so valuable. Like, if Dave could figure out how to do all that technology stuff, like, man, he could blow Brian away.
I hear you, because, like, back before they went together, I used to have a internet prescription for Figure Four Weekly just to hear Meltzer every other Thursday, you know?
Yeah, same. I really subscribe to the Figure Four mostly for a lot of the radio shows.
Yeah, and it was like, man, I'm paying for Meltzer every other week. This kind of sucks, you know? So I was happy when they went together. Now we get Meltzer all the time.
Yeah.
Now now we bitch about him talking about too much MMA over wrestling or vice versa, you know?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I feel like he still talks enough about wrestling. It depends on where his interest lies or what questions he gets. Cause there's still those shows depending on the guest or whoever is, like, whenever they have somebody on, like, especially when it's just like Meltzer and Jericho or Meltzer and Bob Holly, and they're talking for an hour or so, like, those are always the best.
Awesome.
Those, like, pay for the month, and getting both newsletters for just one small price a month. Like, you can't beat that.
Oh, absolutely.
So, and it's funny to see, like, and again, you were saying, you know, with the age of the internet, like, man, this could be the death of the newsletter, because, like, I don't know, like, I'm sure there's ways to get the newsletters every week for free and elsewhere, but, you know, just you figure with the advent of the internet and all this news and rumors and stuff popping up all over the place, like, man, like, so what's the point of these newsletters? But a lot of them, I think, a lot of ways, just kind of confirmation about things you've already heard.
Oh, exactly. That's what the Observer's great for, like, he knows, like, all the news is already out there, and, like, he goes in depth on it, you know?
Yeah.
So it gives you, like, all the details that you just don't get on the cut-and-paste sites and stuff.
Definitely.
But, man, I tell you, like, it's funny, my Observer subscription ran out on Tuesday, and I just renewed it today. So there was, like, 2 days there I didn't have an Observer membership, and I never realized how much of their stuff was behind a paywall before.
Yeah, oh, it's tons. The difference is massive.
Yeah, it's like, wow, man, I had no idea, because, like, I've been, like I said, I've been subscribing off and on since 93 and, like, nonstop since 97. I haven't missed the Wrestling Observer issue since 1997, man.
Wow.
How crazy is that?
That's crazy. So you're reading at, like, the best time in wrestling's history, basically.
Yeah, looking back, the whole Monday Night Wars, man. I remember the Torch the week it came with the headline that WCW was going to start Monday Nitro, and, like, 100% across the board, like, these guys are nuts. They're going to get destroyed. They're going to fail. And this could put them out of business. That was the story across the board. Nobody gave them a chance. Hell, you know?
Yeah. Well, you know, I guess you can't predict the future. They handled it right. They did everything well. Unlike TNA, when they went head to head on Mondays, it was just, you know, that certainly was a mistake. I think there was no denying that. But
yeah, in hindsight, we could definitely go back and say that now.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
At the time, I thought it was the right choice to make. I thought that would actually maybe help the company, but obviously it didn't.
I was excited for the time because I remember watching the first Monday Night shows. Like, Brett was going to be on Raw with Shawn Michaels, and then TNA brought in like Hogan and Bischoff. They were going to have like Hall and Nash and I think Waltman back. Jeff Hardy was coming back to the company. It was like, wow, they really loaded this Monday Night show. I was ready for this prosperous period where both these companies were working their asses off to be the best, and it just never really happened.
I was excited for it till about halfway through the first night they were on Head to Head, and it dawned on me, this is going to fucking suck watching all this wrestling every Monday night.
Yeah.
You can't really watch both at the same time, you know? And it was like back in the old Monday Night Wars, we'd watch the first hour of Nitro, then we'd watch the 2 hours of Raw, and then we'd go back and watch the last 2 hours of Nitro on tape, you know? And I don't miss them five-hour sessions every Monday night whatsoever, you know?
No, not at all. And especially as a kid, like, I would watch – I don't think I did this every week, but like I would usually try to watch the first hour of Nitro. But being a diehard WWF kid, I'd always switch over to Raw. Or if I had to tape one of the two, I'd always choose Raw over Nitro. So for me, exactly. I didn't get those 5 hour marathon sessions because like my parents sure as hell weren't going to let me take up two TVs on a Monday night. What am I, crazy? So yeah, but I know that you wanted to give your side of the story of talking about ECW, and you mentioned the Leonard F. Chikarison episode of Fan to Fan we had. He told the Mick Foley fire chair story, and you were there as well, and you want to tell your side of the tale.
Yeah, man. The infamous October 28th, I believe the date was, 1995. I've never been a fan of fire in wrestling anyway. Like, I don't like any spots with fire because fire doesn't know what the hell is going on. It doesn't know how to work light, you know, like nobody can control fire. And
that's a funny
burns got to suck, you know?
Right.
So like shows before this, they were teasing stuff where Terry Funk would come out with the flaming branding iron on fire, you know? And he's done stuff where like you pile drive cactus on it and shit. And I hated them spots. It like drove me nuts. So Cactus and Funk were working a bunch of IWA Japan shows, and they did a gimmick over there where they had a flaming chair in a couple of matches, you know, and it was selling VHS tapes really good. And so I guess they decided, let's do it over here, you know. And like Leonard Chikarison talked about like the way the chair was on there and whatnot. I don't know a lot about that, but I knew though is Cactus came out with this chair and they lit it on fire. And, like, he took a swing at Terry Funk, you know, purposely to miss, and Funk got out of the ring. Funk took a second swing, like, Cactus took a second swing, and Funk jumped off the ring apron. And Cactus, like, hit the chair against the ring ropes. And what happened is when he hit the chair against the ring ropes, the towel they had wrapped around the chair fell off that was on fire. And it fell directly on Terry Funk, who was down on ringside on the concrete, you know, on his back. And Funk just did what any normal human being would do, is pushed it off himself, you know? And the flaming towel flew into the crowd in the front row. And there's one dude in particular that got burned really bad. And, like, when this was all going on, the lights went out. So the lights went out, like, right as the chair – it's, like, almost perfect timing. Like, they meant it this way. Like, soon as Cactus hit the ropes with the chair, I guess that was supposed to signify put out the lights – and when they came back on, they were going to have Tommy Dreamer crucified from the roof of the building in the Eagle's Nest with Raven standing next to him. But when Cactus hit the chair, the flaming towel fell off the chair and landed on Funk. Funk got it off himself and it went into the crowd. Meanwhile, the lights are out, so all you see is this flames in the crowd. And then they start shooting all these fire extinguishers and everyone just starts running for the exits, you know, like a stampede. And I remember standing there, and this was all happening across from me. Like, I was on the same side of the arena as where the bathrooms were for people that had been there. It was straight across where it would be on the hard camera for the bleachers and stuff back in the day. And like, I was just standing there thinking, somebody's going to die, you know? With this fire, like, all these fire stairs with them fumes everywhere, people rampaging for the door. Insane, man. It's totally, totally insane. And I remember when it was over, like at that point we were going to the Travel Lodge after every show because that's where all the wrestlers stayed and partied. And basically they would rent out the top floor was like a suite, and they would rent that out and tape all the promos for the next month of TV up there. So all the wrestlers had to go back to the Travel Lodge after the show, whether they were staying there or not, you know? So it became party center. And I remember that night, everybody was somber and kind of quiet. And it was just like, everybody thought this was the end of ECW because like everyone knew it was bad and something bad was going to happen, you know?
Yeah, and, so you also thought like this is the end of the company.
Oh, I mean, it was everybody that was there at the hotel that night, man. No, like the wrestlers, everyone thought this could be it, you know? And they did end up losing their promoter's license. I'm not sure who it was, whose license they were using, but they did lose their license over it. And what they did is that's when they brought in the Godfather, Damian Kane, and they started using Damian Kane's license to promote again in Pennsylvania. And that's why he showed up out of nowhere, and he was a manager there for a while, and he was around for maybe a year, and then he disappeared once they got another promoter's license to use, and they didn't need him anymore, you know?
So I asked Chikarson what the craziest thing he can remember seeing in the ECW arena was, and that obviously was his answer. So for you, aside from that, what's like a fond ECW memory you have or something that you saw that kind of just blew your mind?
Man, somebody that one thing that I'll always remember is when they did a scaffold match, High Incident, Tommy Dreamer versus Brian Lee, mm-hmm. where they had a scaffold up near the roof of the building. They had the ring filled with tables, three levels of tables high, and obviously you had to throw your opponent off the scaffold through the tables to win. So they had this; it was like this wooden scaffold that was chained to the ceiling. So this thing was like wobbly and shaky. So literally Brian Lee and Tommy Dreamer, the whole match, they brawled around the ring in the whole building. And then right at the end, they climbed up on this scaffold of death, if you will, you know. Mm. And when Dreamer threw Brian Lee off that thing, he went through three stacks of tables, right? And like his body went through three stacks of tables. Well, I'll never forget, there was three more tables stacked and they didn't move. And the only thing that broke out of each table, his head went through each table. Just the shape of his head missing from three tables.
Wow.
I never seen wrestlers and paramedics get in the ring so fast to get to someone after a spot as that, man. But they were throwing tables trying to get to Brian Lee to make sure he was still alive. I'll never forget that three tables with just a head cut out of them, you know? And nothing else, man. Crazy.
Oof.
But when it comes to crazy stuff, CZW, the shit they've done in that building easily is worse what ECW did back in the day.
Oh, yeah. And it feels like, and not to like shit on CZW, because you could say this about really any indie wrestling company out there today. It just seems like the cultural significance when it comes to professional wrestling, like ECW's moments just, I mean, there's you can't even compare it to what's going on.
Absolutely. Mm. It's so, just ECW was great because the atmosphere, like when we first started going in April of 95, it was probably maybe 800 people there. And by like the summer of 95, man, you couldn't even move. The building was so jacked solid with people that like you couldn't put another person in there if you wanted to. It was ridiculous, you know? Like it was a fire hazard and everything. They had somebody like, they say like 14, 1500, 18. I don't know what the actual number is that they could fit in there, but whatever it was, they were doing it for like a good 2 years straight, you know?
And really, I think the only time I've ever seen the arena packed, because I obviously was not old enough or fortunate enough to go to any of those ECW shows, was it was a Cage of Death a couple of years ago that was just packed.
Yeah, that's the only thing that really comes close would be like Cage of Death shows, mm-hmm. you know?
Which goes to show you, like, still in that area, there is some to the hardcore stuff that people just really, really love.
Yeah, I mean, it has its niche core of people that love to pay to see it. So hey, you know,
well, you are
people do that to themselves. I'll watch it, I guess. You know,
right?
Like, I would never personally do that. And I think it's ridiculous, but if that's what you got to do to put food on your table, I guess each their own, you know?
And I hear like it just kind of through the grapevine that like deathmatch shows are some of the best selling wrestling DVDs out there. Like, I know that they're like, I feel like like maybe it's like IWA Deep South or one of those companies who like does like one show a year and it's a deathmatch tournament.
Yeah, that's basically them. They do their Carnage Cup every year, and then you don't hear from them again until the following year, and it's like coming up like in the next week or so.
Yeah, because you hear, because you like you look at the footage online of like a video or something, like a music video or something like that, and you see there's like eight people there, and it's outside, and you know that's probably still going to be a moneymaker given how many people will buy the DVD or VOD or MP4, whatever it is.
Exactly.
It just has that big audience. It's an interesting – that's the way internet has kind of changed wrestling. You can tell like what sells based on, you know, how many numbers of DVDs and stuff are sold. It's that instant.
Exactly. And I just the other night I watched Card Subject to Change. Finally, did you ever see that documentary?
No, I've heard of it, but I was actually thinking of like the PWG show of the name. But continue.
No, yeah, they do have a show. No, this was a documentary put out in like 2010. And it's like based on the indies, and I just watched it the other night, and I think Necro Butcher, like they talked to him in it, and I think he put it perfect, the why the deathmatch guys do what they do. He was like, I could wrestle, and I could be on the second match of all the shows, but then I look up the card, and I see this guy in main event doing his deathmatch and getting flying around the world. Well, if some asshole's going to do that and get paid, it might as well be me instead of making nothing and working second match on the bottom.
Yeah, there you go.
You know, I mean, obviously the deathmatch guys, they do get paid more for deathmatches, you know?
Right. And like last weekend, I saw a bunch of like School of Rock guys who went and did a deathmatch tournament. And it was like, guys, you just never suspect to ever do that kind of stuff, especially being trained by Billy Rock. And I was like, I wonder what the motivation is for them to do it, just to kind of see if they can do it to I don't know, just maybe get more exposure or to break a certain mold of a certain type. I always wonder what the motivation, and you know, you talked about it with what Necro said, but for guys like that who aren't as big a names as Necro Butcher, like what their motivation is for doing something along those lines. I'd be curious to know.
Definitely. I mean, well, like something like them guys, I don't know. I mean, usually the motivation's money, you know, obviously get paid more to do that stupid shit than just a regular wrestling match.
Well, at least you'd hope so in certain companies anyway.
Yeah, like obviously the guys working Cage of Death are going to get a better paycheck than like working a regular match, for example, you know?
Oh, sure. Yeah. I mean, that is the attraction.
Absolutely. And that's why you see guys willing to do it.
So you watch so many indie companies. It is out of control. How did you initially start getting into indie wrestling? I presume you being tapped into the newsletter community and being a fan of ECW is pretty easy to start getting into like maybe like a Jersey All Pro or Ring of Honor or something like that around your area.
Well, yeah, because there's always been indies out there, but like in the 80s and early 90s, it was very much former WWF or WCW guys. And then the guys underneath were just fucking terrible. You know, like wasn't something you really go to and enjoy yourself. It was just garbage shows.
Mm. And the attraction would be the guys you saw on TV. Then everybody else would be a bunch of nobodies who really didn't.
Exactly.
Work
well. Exactly. You know? And, I mean, I remember Smoky Mountain was out there. Obviously that was out in the Smoky Mountain area, and they went down before ECW. And once ECW went down, it was kind of like, fuck. But even before ECW went down, I remember I used to take a drive every once in a while to the Suncoast Video and see what wrestling they had. And I used to pick up XPW VHS tapes because they started like in the late 90s out in L.A. when they would put their stuff out nationally. And like I said, back then you just had your main three. So another wrestling was like, ooh, cool, something else to watch, you know? And like XPW was never like awesome by any means, but at least it was something totally different, you know?
Yeah, I mean, there is value to going to, you know, your video store, picking up a DVD, and you're like, oh, I know who Jerry Lynn and the Sandman and Super Crazy and these guys are.
Exactly. So 2001 hit, WCW went down, ECW went down. I was like, man, this sucks. And I remember I broke up with a girlfriend, and I was like, man, now I got nothing to fucking do, you know? And I remember seeing an article about CZW in that WOW wrestling magazine that was out at the time that Bill Apter ended up taking over before it went under.
Yeah, I know. I remember the magazine.
Yeah, they had an article about CZW in it. And I remember an RF Video was pushing their VHS tapes in his catalog that he sent out in the mail because ECW went under, so he was looking for something to make money off of. And I was like, man, I wonder where they're running. Maybe I'll check them out. So I went to their website, right? And they have next show, ECW Arena, Cage of Death. I'm like, huh, maybe I'll go to that. I know how to get to the ECW Arena. We'll go check it out. So I took my buddy Joe, and we went down, and I remember it said, like, it was, like, doors at 7, show 7:30. We didn't get into doors till 9:30 at night. And it was like, man, what the fuck kind of promotion is this? But let me tell you, they had a line wrapped around the building from the back corner, came down the corner, went all the way down past Foreman Mills. And so many of them people left. Like, half the line left because they were tired of waiting to get in. Like, they really could have drew, like, twice of what they actually drew at Cage of Death that first time at the ECW Arena. Not that they were going to be able to fit them all in anyway, because they packed the building that night.
Right. I remember going to an indie show and seeing them have to turn away people from the door, and I was like, this is possible? Like, there's this many, right? Like, wrestling fans? It's mind-blowing.
And it was like, the shit I seen that night, man, it was just like... I remember seeing Justice Payne miss a fucking pain throw off the scaffold on the table, wife beater. And it was just like being a guy that came from the fucking early 80s, it was just like, are these kids fucking crazy? You know, what the fuck? But I loved the show, like the atmosphere, and it was so much fun, you know? And there were so many good young kids. I was like, wow, man. Like, I remember like the big hot match off that had the SAT were in it. Against, I believe it was like Quiet Storm and somebody else, you know, yeah, they were doing like
Chris Devine, probably.
Yeah, it was Chris Devine, Quiet Storm, and somebody against Red and the SAT. And I was like, wow, man, that was like crazy, you know?
Maybe Brian XL.
Yeah, that was it. Brian XL, Quiet Storm, and.
Yeah, those guys pretty much did like tons of those six mans, yeah. Those scrambles or whatever together.
It was like, wow, this was pretty neat, you know, and I was still tuning into the wrestling thing. So I knew, like, I knew that Feinstein started Ring of Honor. And so we went to that CZW. Then we tried out Ring of Honor. It was like their third or fourth show. And we went to that, and it was like, man, look at all these fucking guys that, like, I never seen or haven't seen in forever, you know, that were just starting out that were so great. So we went to the third or fourth Ring of Honor show. We didn't miss, like, another local Ring of Honor show for years. We would go to New Jersey, New York, Boston, Maryland, Connecticut, anywhere but the Chicago shows. We were going, you know, for like the first so many years of Ring of Honor. And then we started going to Jersey All Pro every show, and Chikara when Chikara started working around more than just their like their school in Allentown and stuff. It was like, before I knew it, I was going to indie shows every weekend, you know? And I went from, wow, wrestling's dead in 2001 to going to indie shows every weekend and seeing, like, CM Punk and Samoa Joe and Chris Daniels and Loki, you know, and, like, all this greatness every weekend.
Oh, man, I got to ask, as a big fan, tell me about some of the early Chikara shows you went to.
See, Chikara, here's the thing, like... Let me backtrack a little bit, because when I was talking about Damian Kane came in the ECW's and they started using his promoter's license. At the time, we were just turned 21, and like any wrestling fan, we all grew up wanting to be pro wrestlers, you know? So me and three of my buddies, we hooked up with Damian Kane, and he was running a school in Reading. So we went down to a school in Reading, and we all had a tryout, and we were all like, you know, couple classes, and my buddy Billy's the only one that really stuck with it and actually ended up in the business. Like me, I've always had a bad back, so it was like weird for me to bump. So I was always letting like Damien kill me with everything, so I knew it would look good, you know. And he was like, dude, I'm afraid to train you, man. I'm gonna hurt you bad, you know. He's like, you're not bumping right, and it's like you're taking everything. So I didn't end up like, he's like, you should be like a referee or a manager. And I wish I did the thing and became a referee, because everybody's always looking for good referees, you know? So after that, like, I didn't do any more wrestling after a few classes, but my buddy Billy stuck with it, and it became Lucifer Grimm. And he worked a lot around, like, the late 90s and early 2000s working around on the indies. And he was actually the guy that was in the ring with Gary Albright when he died in Allentown, Pennsylvania, or actually Hazleton, Pennsylvania. If you remember that from 2000.
I do, yes.
Because it was weird, because, like, my buddy Billy, like, he's, like, 6'3", and, like, 240, like, the perfect size for a wrestler, you know? And, like, he's the type that would never go and work out in the gym. So he had like a gut and he didn't have big muscles, but he became like a tremendous worker for a bigger guy, you know? And like when Afa Jr. first started wrestling, literally for like, I'd say the first 6 months, Billy was the only one that Afa would let his son in the ring with and the only one he trusted, you know? And anytime like anybody big came to WXW, they'd usually put him with Billy for side. Like when Batista walked in the door and said, I want to be a pro wrestler, it was Billy who was the one that was in the ring with him every day because he was the only guy close to his size, you know?
Oh, wow.
Or like Gene Snitsky was there. He'd always work Billy. Like all the different guys would come through. But when Billy first started training, we all went to Damian Kane. Billy stuck with it. He moved to Reading and he was training under Damian Kane. And Damian, like a lot of trainers, just picked up and took off one day, you know, and kind of fucked over all the students and just disappeared, you know. Once he stopped working for ECW, he just packed up and moved away. So most of the guys that were training at Damian Kane's school moved across town to a school named Dio's Dungeon that a lot of guys were training at. A lot of guys that worked PCW back in the day. So, like, I would go down and hang out with my buddy Billy at the school, even though I wasn't trained. I'd sit in on the classes, just take it in all as a sponge just for my love for wrestling. And, like, I remember we moved over to this other school. It was just this garage, and I don't even know where in Reading. But, like, I remember hanging out there, and, like, Steve Carino was there training. Lance Diamond was there training, who'd go on to be Simon Diamond. Mike Quackenbush was just starting out. Like, all these guys are there training, you know, and even a bunch of guys like the Cremators of the world that never went anywhere. But I, like, Chikaris and I specifically remember, like, the first so many times we're there, like, I'd be sitting there, they had, like, stacks of wrestling magazines, you know, in a wrestling school, go figure. So I was just sitting there on the couch watching, and I'm thinking, man, why is this dude the only one in the ring? And everyone's, like, hanging outside the ring, you know? And, like, my buddy Billy come on, I'm like, yo, what's up with this? He's like, oh, that dickhead in the ring, that's Mike Quackenbush. He's like, nobody wants to work with him. All he wants to do is high flying moves he's seen off Japanese VHS tapes.
Oh no.
The fuck at everybody. Right? And it's like great to see Quack start as that and end up where he's at is pretty fucking amazing, I think.
Totally. Yeah. I mean,
you know?
Built one of the what was like the top company that Smart Mark Video had, arguably one of the one or two indie wrestling companies in America.
Yeah, like amazing, great. You know? To be there at them early stages, see this kid that just came in doing backyard stuff, you know, and it's like awesome to see guys like that, you know, really and get like, it together and make it something out of themselves.
And watching like those shows from like 2003, 2004, where they're barely drawing flies and,
yeah,
you know, the wrestling is just not up to snuff. There's not very many storylines to turn them into this juggernaut that people just they're just, you know, dying for any bit of information about the company's resurgence to come out now. It says a lot.
So yeah, because cool. Clearly when it first started, Chikara was just it was just a way for the students to work in front of a live crowd, you know.
Yeah.
And it's slowly built from there. And like so we wouldn't go to shows too often, but then they started bringing in different guys, you know, and they would run like since I'm from the Northeast, they would run all these weird places that weren't far from my house. So we'd go to the show and there'd be like 30 people there, 40 people there. And we'd watch these shows. There'd always be like awesome gems on them. Like they'd bring in guys from Pro Wrestling Guerrilla. Like I remember seeing Joey Ryan on the shows and like Chris Bosh and Scott Lost and the Young Bucks and like so many different guys before they were even stars other places, you know. Like Chikara was great for giving these people their first actual chance to get out there and work in front of people.
Yeah, I do believe Chikara was the first East Coast company to give the Young Bucks a break.
Exactly.
If memory serves me correctly, so good on them.
It's like hell, CM Punk and Colt Cabana were on the very first Chikara, or no, that was actually, I'm sorry, that was actually the very first 3PW show they were on. But Chikara, man, like they would draw nobody. And then to me, it seems like right around the time they hit the ECW arena is when things really took off for them.
Oh, yeah. You know? Totally. Just, again, increased visibility, a building that fans were used to going to from the area. It's not tough to see why. Partnering up with CZW at the time. Visibility
across the board. But I'll never forget that they ran this venue, which I know you'll remember, called The Staircase.
Great place. Very sad I never got to go to it.
That's literally 2 minutes from where I'm sitting right now talking to you on this.
Oh, gosh.
Yeah. Like, the Staircase is a legendary rock club, and it used to, like, be down the road from where it's at. And where it was at, they decided they wanted to build a strip mall. So they actually tore down your old rock club and paid them money to build a new one right where it was at. And after, like, so many years, they closed down and sold the place after they basically got it for free, which really kind of pissed me off. But I would always go there for concerts, like Breaking Benjamin when they were first starting out because they're from this town, and stuff like that would always play there, you know? And I was thinking, man, this would be awesome for wrestling. And I actually sat down and talked to building management once about bringing wrestling there, and they just really weren't into the idea, you know? And I was like, man, I think this was something that worked. And then somehow Chikara got in there, which good for them, you know? And, like, until that point, like, we never had any type of good independent wrestling in this area. And it was like, wow, I can't wait to see how this show does. And that very first show was the final night of the Tag Team Grand Prix. And they, like, packed the place with, like, 250 people, you know? And it was, like, bizarre to sit in my own hometown and see, like, a loaded indie show that is jammed to the gills in this building where I live, you know?
Yeah, that's always the best. That's like, for me, that would have been when Ring of Honor ran Manassas, Virginia a couple times. And like, right. That was maybe 10 or 15 minutes down the road. And I was just like, you, like, I remember my friend texted me, telling me they're running there. And I thought he was joking. Like, he was just messing with me. And then sure enough, they ran there. And I was like, this is the best. And then, of course, they had to go 2 hours south, but that's neither here nor there. So, but speaking of indie wrestling and good stuff around here, like I said, you watch just all these promotions. I'm not even going to list them because that would just be it. We'd be here for another hour. But
anything that Smart Mark puts out, like High Spots, like Pro Wrestling Guerrilla, like anything that's out there on DVD that's pretty decent, we pretty much check most of it out, man. But I
have to wonder, how do you find the time to watch all this? Because I watch a lot of wrestling, but you watch way more than I do, or anybody I think does.
Well, any of the we watch all the live pay-per-views, so Friday, Saturday, Sunday, whenever they're on, that's not a problem. And then we have, like, Sunday and Tuesday night are our designated independent wrestling show nights where we watch a show each night. So that's pretty much how we do it. Pretty much two shows a week plus live pay-per-views on the weekend.
Right, and that, of course, is you and Uncle Mike watching all of these shows. Your podcasting buddy.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly, you know. And it was like, we were like, Like I started the podcast event. I don't even know how that even, like my buddy Mike Falcone was podcasting with Tom Green. And they were doing the Mike and Tom show. And they had me on 1 week to talk about, like, ECW and the Travelodge. I was like, yeah, I'll come on and reminisce. That'd be great. And, like, they got a lot of great reviews and whatnot. And, like, so they started having me on a regular basis. And I was like, cool. And then we started, like, I'll go to a lot of indie shows now with Mike Falcone. So we would do a live review of the show right after to put on their weekly show. And then something happened where Tom Green couldn't do the show anymore. And before I knew it, I was the co-host on the show. I was never asked. Like, it was never planned. It just all of a sudden, here I was co-hosting the show with Mike Falcone, you know?
Right.
But we'd only do a show like once a month, you know? And it was cool. We'd get like great reviews. But in the back of my mind, like doing this podcast, I'm like, man, we can really do something with this where we could really, you know, make a difference, like help get guys noticed that people don't know, help promotions get noticed, let people know what the good shows are to get. And I was like, man, I'd like to do a weekly show where we have a live guest on, review some live shows and preview what's coming up that weekend, you know? And like Falcone, like, just wasn't into doing a weekly thing. So I was like, fuck it, man, I'm going to do my own thing and do a weekly thing. And here we are 64 weeks later. Banging them out every Wednesday, man.
Yeah, so now that we're getting here close to the end of the hour, where can people find the Uncle Mike and Tom show?
Right now you can find us at www.indiewrestlingworld.com/Uncle Mike and Tom. That's our homepage. It's got all our shows archived there. You can find us on Stitcher and iTunes, as we're both on there under Wrestling Smash. And I posted on all the most popular wrestling message boards. So if you go to any message boards, you can usually find us somewhere on there. Or you can just do a Google search for the Uncle Mike and Tom Show. Find us on there. We're on Twitter and Facebook under the Uncle Mike and Tom Show. Twitter's at Mike Tom Show. You can like us on Facebook and get the show every week on your timeline. All that good stuff.
Yeah, and we could follow you on Twitter at the Tom Richards.
Yeah,
very valuable stuff. I get a lot of my pay-per-view results from you. So
it's awesome, man. That's the idea, man. Get the word out about shows so people know they're going on. Because like this is what I find about a lot of indie shows is they put on these great shows and people just don't know about it. And I think if more people knew, they would come and they would watch and they would buy the DVDs, you know? So helping get the word out, I think, is half the battle.
I've been told many times for Pro Wrestling Ponderings from various people, you guys seem to be doing a better job promoting some of these shows than the actual companies themselves. So
I know, it's scary, isn't it?
It is kind of scary. Yeah, but hey, it's fans like you and others out there who I think really help independent wrestling. So I think your podcast and your Twitter, all that's good stuff for it. So I appreciate it as a fellow wrestling fan.
I appreciate you listening, man. Like that's been our thing from day one. It's not about me. It's not about Uncle Mike. Like if we wanted to become popular, known, we certainly wouldn't be talking about independent pro wrestling. You know, it's all about the independent promotions and the independent wrestlers that deserve the press that they're not getting. Cause like I would get so mad. Like I read the Wrestling Observer, like I said, every week. And like Meltzer's got so much, you know, hooked up with MMA now that he really doesn't cover independent pro wrestling. And except for like your website, there's very few places that really cover independent pro wrestling. It's a shame that that coverage is missing, you know?
We try, man. We try to do our best, and I know you're doing your best, too. And I think if there's enough people out there talking about it, there's going to be some good to come of it eventually, if it hasn't already.
Definitely, man. I think we're all doing good.
Well, again, go ahead and check out the Uncle Mike and Tom show. Do a Google search for it. Look for it on Stitcher and iTunes, and follow Tom over at The Tom Richards on Twitter. And Tom, thanks so much for sitting down and doing the show with me. I really appreciate it.
It's been a blast, man. I appreciate you having me on. My return to Pro Wrestling Ponderings, if you will.
That's right. Long awaited.
Right?
Well, thanks again, man. I really appreciate it.
Thanks, man. It's been fun.
And there you have it. Chat with Tom Richards. I want to thank Tom again. Be sure to follow him on Twitter at the Tom Richards. Go ahead and check out the Uncle Mike and Tom podcast. Lots of great interviews and independent wrestling talk over there. So if you're a fan of pwponderings.com and you're wrestling, you're certainly going to check his show out. Again, I want to plug at pwponderings on Twitter, at WrestleFolks on Twitter. Be sure to follow both of them. Listen to all the shows on both podcast networks. And in terms of PW Ponderings, read the reviews, read the articles. Check out everything else you got on the website. And again, go to pwponderings.com. If you're going to be purchasing stuff through High Spots and or Amazon, please use our banners. Tell your friends to use the banners. Do what you can to help us out. You can follow me on Twitter at kford13. In addition to this podcast over at pwponderings.com, there will be a new episode of the Cool Kids Table podcast where myself, Brad Gruen, and Justin Houston talk all about Dragon Gate in Japan and a little bit about Dragon Gate USA as well. So if you're interested in those companies, I highly recommend checking that out. But I'll also be back next week with a brand new episode of the Fan to Fan podcast with a great, unique guest. I already recorded the episode as I'm doing this outro, and I loved it. I had a great time doing it. So I really hope you'll be back in 7 to check out the new episode. And until then, thanks so much for listening, and thank you for being a fan. Come on, come on, baby, tell